dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Who better to give us an intelligence briefing than a man who devoted his professional career, some 30 years in duration, in the uniform of the United States Navy as a naval intelligence professional? His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, who rose through the ranks, among other things, to be the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is these days a senior fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with ours here in Washington, D.C. We very much value his participation in this program always, especially when he gives us a full hour of his time, as he's graciously doing today. Captain Fennell, welcome aboard, sir. Good to have you back. Jim, a top of mind, I think, for most of us who are concerned about what Communist China is up to is the seeming inexorable increase in provocative behavior and belligerent rhetoric on the part of the Chinese Communist Party and its military, the People's Liberation Army, towards Taiwan, a sovereign state recognized as such by a number of nations around the world that is part of the free world, for sure, and yet is considered by China to be part of China, and successive administrations have gone along with that line more or less. Give us an intelligence briefing, if you would, Jim, on sort of the order of battle that the Chinese have mustered, seemingly for the purposes of invading Taiwan, and whether we are at the cusp of such a kinetic action by them.
Well, Frank, the situation regarding Taiwan right now is very, I'd say, critical in terms of the posturing that the PLA has made and has been making in this year of 2020. There's been a lot of reporting come out just recently. As of about a week ago, we had reports from the Taiwan Ministry of Defense saying that the Chinese mainland had conducted 51 warplane sorties in 16 days since mid-September. They also announced earlier this week.
And when you say sorties, Captain, you're talking about not just flying around over China or even over the Chinese side of the Taiwan Straits. You're talking about actually incursions into Taiwanese airspace some 50 times?
Yeah, this last week, Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense said that China conducted, the PRC, had conducted 49 military aircraft sorties across the Taiwan Strait median line just this year. That's the highest number since 1990. And they've conducted over 1,700 military aircraft sorties and 1,000 military vessel sorties into the Taiwan Air Defense Identification Zone just this year. So it's dramatic increases from just 5 years ago when I retired, the amount of activity. And it's really putting a stress toll on the Taiwan Ministry of Defense. Their reaction to these sorties have basically cost them almost 10% of their defense budget, about 8.7% here already, just to respond to these incursions. Because what basically China's doing is sending bombers escorted by fighters with airborne command post aircraft, early warning aircraft, all converging, making runs at China or from China to mainland right across at Taiwan. They're circumnavigating and surrounding Taiwan with these bomber flights escorted again by fighters armed with missiles, naval vessels and ships also circumnavigating around Taiwan. And just really, if you get the sense of a noose is around Taiwan's neck and Beijing's just inching it tighter and tighter and tighter, kind of like jerking it right now. And it's really been exacerbated since January with the the re-election of the current president, Tsai Ing-wen, and her Democratic Progressive Party, which has not kowtowed to Beijing and, you know, done what they've said. And so China's really, really turned up the heat in this military way. You know, they've had 20 years of military modernization where they've built, a strategic rocket force that's got at least 12 to 1,500 short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles that are pointed at Taiwan. They've developed and reorganized their military structure. So they've created a new battle theater command. So they have an Eastern Theater Command that's a joint organization with a joint command post that stood up. And they're focused on, taking Taiwan back. They would like to do it without violence, but they're now showing their cards, if you will, to say, if things get worse, we will try to use military force to take Taiwan. Now, a lot of people think that this is all a bluff and that they're just trying to, again, use, coercion tactics to get the folks in Taiwan to capitulate and to accept some kind of inevitability of Beijing and the Chinese Communist Party's rule. But polls here recently in Taiwan show that more and more young people are saying, we don't want to be part of the People's Republic of China, and we don't want to be ruled by them. So in a way, Beijing's actually making the situation worse than if they'd kind of have a looser effort and continue to use nonviolent methods to get what they want.
Obviously, those young people in part are responding, I assume, to what they've been watching happen in Hong Kong and another part of the free world that was recently gobbled up by the Chinese Communist Party. Is a pretty ominous sign.
Yes, it is. And Xinjiang, I would say, obviously what happened to Hong Kong is clearly the most perfect example for the people of Taiwan to see that when the Chinese Communist Party says that we will have one country, two systems, and we'll allow the people of Hong Kong to exist peacefully, and then to watch that eroded completely this year and destroyed, and all the agreements that the PRC made with Britain back in the 80s, to see all that just go away in 1 year without any consideration of the people of Hong Kong. The people of Taiwan know that the same thing awaits them, and they've seen it implemented out in the West in Xinjiang. They've seen what's happened in Tibet. So they know that what will surely be in store for them is a lack of freedom, a lack of liberty, a lack of ability to just live one's life the way that they'd like to. And I think this is really starting to compound it. But I think the real question right now is, what are the Taiwan people going to do? What is the Taiwan government going to do to really get after this? Because there's also polls that say that there's a generation of people that don't really want to defend and fight for their independence and freedom. And so this is a problem that I know that the current administration in Taiwan is concerned about and having to deal with.
Jim, hold the thought, because what they're going to do is very much central to what we have to be able to do as well and how we do it. We'll be right back with more with Jim Fennell about indicators and warnings of what's coming next in Taiwan and what has to be done to protect it. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're visiting for this full hour with one of the most distinguished and knowledgeable former military officers in the United States Armed Forces, Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, an intelligence professional who has spent almost all of his 30 years in uniform, assessing, monitoring, and warning about the coming threat from Communist China. What I'm interested in, Jim, is if you would take the sort of level setting that you did in the first block and apply it to what you would be doing if you were still advising the Pacific Fleet about what the Chinese are up to. Are there indicators and warnings that are sufficiently problematic at the moment to translate into a much higher level of readiness on the part of our forces, or should they? And to the extent that these exercises you described are sort of blurring the sort of state of the intentions as well as the actual capabilities of the People's Liberation Army towards Taiwan, how does that affect your intelligence assessment?
Yes, Frank, the question of indication and warning is a very important question, and one that dominates the intelligence professionals at the Indo-PACOM and the components and our allies, obviously in Taiwan and in Japan. And these activities that I mentioned in the first segment about the increased air and naval activity around Taiwan that's dramatically ramped up here in 2020, this makes it much harder to predict when China would be willing or the PRC would be willing to conduct an invasion of Taiwan. And we use the term strategic warning. And when I was on active duty, strategic warning was something that we thought we had a fairly good handle on, and that we could see the movement and massing of troops. And many, you know, out on the internet, there's probably dates that are listed, and I don't want to get into specifics, but I would just say right now, given the volume of activity from the PRC and the PLA against Taiwan this year, that strategic warning window has shrunk from, greater than maybe 30 days to something much less than that. And that makes puts a higher premium on whether or not the forces in Taiwan and the U.S. are ready and prepared to deal with a sudden invasion. And I think, you know, that's a dangerous area to be in, because it means that your forces have to be on a higher level of readiness. And when you're on a higher level of readiness, that means you're spending and using your military forces much at a higher rate, which means they wear down faster, which means they need more money, and you need more planes and more ships and things of that, and more people to sustain that level of readiness. And China knows that. But I still think, in terms of an actual invasion, the one thing that would be the biggest giveaway would be the massing of ground forces that would surely be used to conduct an invasion. I, for one, do not believe that China would launch missiles and airstrikes into Taiwan and then just be satisfied that that would achieve the goal. I think if they pull the trigger, then they will come all the way, and that will require hundreds of thousands of Chinese PLA soldiers that will have to come across in various methods and means across that strait. And I think we will be able to see that. How much time we would have to see that and understand exactly what it is, that's another question, and that's really the hardest part of the intelligence dilemma in this, which is to say, if China is doing a ground force exercise on the Fujian coast, which is 90 to 100 miles away, when do we see this as not just an exercise, but as the actual preparations for an invasion? And there are specific areas that we can look at, and I know that the intelligence community is, and it's the size of the force and the speed of the force and what materials that are coming with the force. And so that's the challenge for us on the PRC side and the PLA. They keep trying and testing mobilization. So you'll see a lot of reports this year about the mobilization of the PLA Air Force, the PLA Airborne Corps, the PLA Army, ground forces, artillery pieces, strategic rocket force assets that are moving around and being mobilized. So you'll see these exercises where the Northern Theater Command will, relocate to the Western Theater Command, or the Eastern Theater Command will conduct something to the Northern Theater Command, or the Southern Theater Command will do something to the Western Theater Command. And you'll see this movement of some facet of the PLA. That's all training to be ready to take Taiwan. They can go internally to China, but use those experiences of mobilization thousands of troops to say, this is how we would do it when we would attack Taiwan. And so it's important for us to watch that.
No question. But this kind of shell game that they're playing is making that more difficult, and you've made that clear. I would argue, Jim, that it's important that we recall that a very central element of Chinese military doctrine is deception. So to the extent that some of this is going on, not just for training, but also to desensitize us or to make us look over here instead of over there, that would be part of the normal operating practices of the People's Liberation Army. But a second thought, Jim, and it's a kind of thought experiment, I guess, as much as anything. You are a valued member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, which I have the privilege of being vice chairman of. One of our other members is Richard Fisher, very eminent expert on the Chinese order of battle and their conduct of their forces, as are you, of course. One of the things that Rick has been pointing out for some time is that American commercial aircraft, which China has bought in large quantities, as well as having now begun to produce some of their own indigenously, to say nothing, of course, of military transport and dedicated airlift and that sort of thing. But these commercial aircraft can be used to move immense numbers of personnel or occupying forces into, you know, a place like Taiwan once, you know, the resistance has been suppressed and airfields, you know, taken and all the rest. So it's not just, you know, ground forces or amphibious lift for those ground forces that we have to be monitoring, is it? It would seem that we also have to be trying to keep tabs on this other so-called civilian but inherently dual-use airlift capability as well.
No question about it, Frank. I mean, Mao called it the people's war, and it's the same concepts today. And if the people use civilian airliners to move around and travel around and go on vacations, they will also use those same civilian airlines in a war to take Taiwan. The same with merchant vessels and merchant ships and commercial cargo vessels. We've seen that as well. We've seen it back in the early 2000s, commercial vessels having artillery pieces strapped on the deck. They're not so obvious doing that much these days, but the same kinds of organizational structure where these civilian commercial airliners and cargo fleets are all somehow linked politically to the Chinese Communist Party and have roles and missions to play in any invasion scenario is a well-established fact.
Jim, that's a good segue point, it seems to me, to talk a bit about what China has been doing, not just to prepare for the invasion of Taiwan, but also to prevent the United States or other allied forces from coming to its relief in the event that the Chinese do go for it on the island of Taiwan. And your point about these commercial ships and in the past having artillery pieces strapped to their decks. The Russians have been, as you know, marketing for some time, and I'm sure that the Chinese have bought or have replicated in their own right, these cargo containers that have actually been adapted to house missiles inside them of various kinds. What evidence do we have that those are now part of the Chinese order of battle on these so-called commercial vessels that are, as you say, at the beck and call, if needed, by the military?
Yeah, the Russians had kind of came out with this several years ago, their Club S caliber missiles, anti-ship cruise missile systems that fit in these containers that you see on cargo ships. There is some evidence that China has this capability. I haven't seen a lot of reporting on it. And to be honest, the amount of material that they have in terms of launching missiles at Taiwan with the Strategic Rocket Force and their normal PLA Army and Air Force and naval assets is pretty high. I think these missile systems that you're talking are really of concern to the United States and our rear echelons. For instance, if a Chinese cargo ship was headed to Guam or even to Hawaii or into Tokyo Bay, what could they do and what kind of havoc could they wreak? And this is an area that we need a lot more information on. But it has to be considered as part of the process.
Talk a little bit about the doctrine that the Chinese have adopted to deny us access to Taiwan and to keep us out of that part of the Western Pacific and the kinds of capabilities that they've been putting into place for that purpose.
Well, I've mentioned a couple of things about, you know, missile systems. And so they have the Dongfeng 21, the Dongfeng 26, which are, you know, medium range, intermediate range ballistic missiles designed specifically to sink our aircraft carriers. So in that arena, they've built a whole plethora of ballistic missiles that are launched from the mainland of China, seeking out our big deck carriers, not just our aircraft carriers, but our amphibious carriers as well.
Those anti-ship ballistic missiles are purportedly intended to be able to take out these incredibly important assets underway, moving targets, in other words. Just what's your working assumption about their effectiveness? Have they been tested in that role yet? Or if they haven't, do you credit them as being real threats to our big deck carriers and amphibs?
I credit them as being a real threat. And the most recent activity was at the end of August. It was on the 25th of August when a salvo, four missiles of the 21 and 26 variant were launched from mainland China, two different places, one in the north, one in the west, and they went, or the east, not in the west, in the east, and they were launched into a closure area south of Hainan Island, but north of the Paracels. So in that area where we operate many times, and they were reportedly, from the sources that I know, indicating that maybe they were against targets that were maneuvering, or at least in motion. So I give them full credit.
This is a point to which we will return in just a moment. We're continuing this conversation with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired former Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, just on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting for this full hour with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a man who spent his 30 years in uniform assessing and giving early warning wherever possible about the growing danger from the Chinese Communist Party and its military, the People's Liberation Army and Navy and Air Force. Captain Fennell, thank you again for your time today. This is always edifying, if often very chilling. You were talking about the Chinese having, you think, successfully not only put into place, but actually demonstrated an ability to threaten our carriers and other big deck ships underway, which has to have an impact on how our naval commanders would use those vessels, whether it's for the purpose of trying to come to the aid of Taiwan under attack, or Japan, or the Australians, for heaven's sakes. I mean, the threat, the ambitions of the Chinese are now pretty much region-wide, aren't they? And I'd just be interested in sort of your assessment of what all these capabilities, and we could, mention others, some unmanned vessels and unmanned underwater weapon systems and artificial intelligence, as well as, the missiles and so on that we've been discussing. How does this shape our Navy's thinking about its mission in that region today?
Well, Frank, I think the threat from the Chinese counter-intervention strategy, which we refer to as anti-access area denial, has been developed for 20 years. They've been working on all kinds of systems, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, a bigger Navy, a bigger Air Force, a Space Force, a cyber force, all designed to keep the United States military outside of the second island chain so that they could do what they needed to do to take the South China Sea and the Senkakus and ultimately Taiwan. And this layered attack, if you will, to drive us away is not unknown to the United States Department of Defense. So, for instance, the Dongfeng 21 was a missile system that, when I was at the Office of Naval Intelligence in 2006 or 2008, we were aware of and studying. So we've had over a decade of awareness of this. And so there are tools and techniques and ploys that we have to defeat those systems or to degrade their capability. And obviously, we're working on them. And obviously, in the case of a defense of Taiwan, our carriers and our forces would need to get in closer. But I think what you've seen here recently is from this administration and most recently Secretary of Defense Esper's speech a week or so ago, talking about a 500-ship Navy, which I find very encouraging, and the fact that much of that's going to be a mixture of smaller ships and unmanned ships is a nod to the reality of how future naval war may occur in the Western Pacific because of the volume of anti-ship and ballistic missiles that the Chinese have built and brought to bear. And so the days of saying that we're going to sail in a 1,000-foot-long, Nimitz-class carrier or a Ford-class carrier that weighs, 100,000 tons and have 50 to 75 jets on board and just going to sail out there and sit and operate and fly without having to dodge incoming missiles from space, from aircraft, from surface ships, and from submarines. Those days are gone. And so we're having to adapt now. And I think the real challenge for us is to adapt ourselves before the conflict has even occurred. Whereas in World War II, we adapted from the battleship Navy to the aircraft carrier Navy after we lost the majority of our battleships on 7 December 1941.
So, Jim, you've described a pretty daunting prospect here, that we will face a large and modern and qualitatively as well as quantitatively challenging adversary who has gone to school on us and how we operate and presumably learned the lessons from our previous engagements so as to maximize the danger for our naval forces. And I appreciate what you're saying about, you know, efforts that we've been making to contend with all of this, but a 500-ship Navy is a very ambitious task, is it not, given the small size of the Navy today? And even though I think Mark Esper said we're going to have that goal reached in 2045, which is a long time from now, can you get there from here, do you think? And if so, what will it take? And speak to this point that it has to be something different than just more of the same, more of the same big deck carriers, for example.
Yeah, I think, I'll just say I've always given my assessments based on what I consider the threat. And so I use threat-based assessment to make my recommended policy recommendations. And so for the last 5 to 10 years, I've been very frustrated because we've not talked about the number of ships that the PRC has and the number of missiles that they can throw downrange at the U.S. Navy. And we had people in Washington inside the Beltway that were making our Navy, future Navy projections based on not the threat, but based on budget dollars that they thought they could get out of the Congress. And that's not the way to defend the nation. And so for years, people have told me I was crazy when I said we needed more than 355 ships. And I know that people are saying that Secretary Esper's comments are 500 or is unachievable and it's not until 2045. Okay, fine. But if you're not going to build something that's going to be able to compete with the PRC and the PLA Navy, then you might as well not spend a nickel on it. You might as well just give up and go home, because a force of 350 ships that doesn't have anti-ship cruise missiles to the same number and volume of as the Chinese Navy simply cannot survive. And so we're going to have to do something as a nation to say this is a serious priority. If we think the $5 trillion of American and European goods that go through the South China Sea and even more through the East China Sea and across the Pacific are not worth our time and effort.
This is a critical point, obviously, Jim. Compared to what, you know, are those dollars going to be allocated? If, as we have been throughout our history, really, we are a maritime nation dependent upon the waters of the world's oceans to transit, you know, goods and raw materials and to export our products, for that matter, anybody else controlling those waters. And that's clearly what the Chinese have set themselves to do in certainly the South China Sea, and I think increasingly it's evident in the East China Sea as well. That's a real threat to our commercial viability, but also to our national security. Talk, Jim, if you would, quickly about what you were seeing during the latter period of your time in service taking place on these so-called atolls in the Pacific under construction by the Chinese Communist Party's various entities.
Yeah, we were watching, the events after, just right before and right after the Scarborough Shoal incident of April through June of 2012, when we essentially allowed the PRC to take sovereign territory from the People's Republic or the Republic of the Philippines, our treaty ally. And right at that time, I think the Chinese recognized that the United States wasn't going to stand up to its treaty commitments, and they went all out to build these seven islands down in the South China Sea. And we started watching and seeing, you know, dredgers come down. And at first it was hard to understand. Was this just a local project or one-off? But it quickly became apparent that This was an organized, dedicated plan to build military installations in the South China Sea. And here we are now, almost 8 years later, and the Chinese have 7 new military bases in the South China Sea, 3 of which are really significant and are the size of Pearl Harbor in terms of their physical size and the fact that they have major runways that are 3,000 meters long, 10,000 feet, and major port facilities that can, you know, have aircraft carrier-sized vessels pull up pierside, at least 2 in each one of those, Subi Reef, Mystic Reef, and Fiery Cross Reef.
So what does that mean, as a practical matter, Jim Fennell, in terms not only of power projection from those bastion islands, but the ability essentially to dictate who can transit those waters or fly over them, for that matter?
Exactly. And I think the Chinese have, you know, they told President Obama, we're not going to militarize them. That was a lie. They told the world that they wouldn't shut off commercial traffic. We don't know that yet. It hasn't actually happened. But we don't have to wait until the Chinese start stopping interrogating, commercial vessels and holding them in a penalty box, if you will, before we start waking up to this eventuality. So I think that's the real concern, is that we sometimes are in this age of, well, we can't assess something against an adversary until they actually do it. And that's not called intelligence work. That's called stupidity. We should be projecting ahead based on what they say, what they're doing, what they've built, and their strategic intentions. And they have built those bases down there to extend China's sovereign control over the South China Sea, 900 miles from the mainland of China. And they're operating there today in larger numbers than ever before. And we just had a report, I think, in the last month, they talked about how they had a report of a fighter aircraft that operated for 10 hours down in the South China Sea. It doesn't take 10 hours to fly from Hainan Island down to Mischief Reef. It only takes about 2 hours. So that means that jet aircraft, that fighter aircraft, is operating and you know, not just doing a straight line transit, but was operating and flying in a combat role and training. And we've also seen them flying bombers down there as well.
Jim, we have to pause for just a second, but I do want to say their declared purpose is to exercise dominion over those areas of the Western Pacific, to require people to get their permission to, as I say, steam through them or fly over them. So this isn't something that we have to speculate too much about. That's where they want to go with this, for sure. Pause with me, folks, for just 1 second, and we'll be right back with the final block of this very important, very timely interview with Captain James Fennell, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily interesting and, well, a little worrying assessment by a former top intelligence officer in the United States Navy, Captain James Fennell, now retired, now with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, and a very active contributor to the public policy debate about China and what it's up to and what we best be doing about it. And Jim, I did want to turn to that now. We've discussed Mark Esper's vision of a vastly larger fleet, which is clearly needed, especially since, well, it goes without saying to somebody like you, but for most of us, we tend to forget, we have to be strong all over the world. China predominantly has to be strong in its littoral waters, and that creates a doubly difficult task for a fleet that's certainly way too small at the moment. But let's talk a little bit about policies that the United States needs to be pursuing now during this period when we're hopefully rebuilding our capabilities. Jim, start maybe with Taiwan. Talk a little bit about this so-called strategic ambiguity that has long characterized American policy towards the defense of Taiwan, and what you think the Chinese are making of it today.
Well, Frank, just recently, National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien gave a speech in Las Vegas last week and talked about this whole issue of Taiwan and how he just boldly stated that, hey, China, if you try to take Taiwan, it's going to not be an easy task and you're going to suffer for it. And he used a reference to the term a porcupine strategy, which is something that was authored by Navy War College professor Bill Murray back in 2008, which is essentially a recommendation to Taiwan to become armed to the teeth like a porcupine and make it very difficult for China to attack them. And in that speech, O'Brien mentioned the idea, oh, by the way, you know, this thing of strategic ambiguity, which said for 40 years that we wouldn't decide whether or not who we supported, that we just wanted a peaceful resolution to the, you know, the civil war, if you will, between the Chinese Communist Party and the Kuomintang. And so we've had this kind of policy that we wouldn't say who should be the right rightful you know, China, that we just supported a one country, two systems, and that we would hopefully that would be resolved peacefully, and that we encouraged the status quo to be maintained until that was peacefully resolved. Well, O'Brien's mentioning of strategic ambiguity in Nevada last week is a clear and unambiguous signal that this administration is willing even to relook at that policy. And I would encourage them to relook at it. And I think it's time now for the United States to unequivocally declare to Beijing that if you take Taiwan, it will be considered an act of war against the United States and our allies in the region. And while we don't have a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan like we do with Japan or Australia or other treaty allies in the region, and there is no Article 5, which is if one is attacked, then we come to the defense of the one attacked. In that treaty, right, exactly like NATO, it's the same Article 5 language. We don't have that in writing with Taiwan, but I think we're at a point now in history where if we don't make a definitive and undeclared or a declarative statement to Beijing that you do attempt this and you will pay dearly for it, and people will poo-poo this and say that that's you know, radical talk and it's alarmist talk and it's warmongering, and I would just say, yeah, you can say that if you're sitting in safety, maybe in safety from some of their ballistic missiles, maybe not. But if you're in Taiwan or you're an American sailor or American airman or American Marine stationed in Asia and China doesn't get that declaration of unambiguous support for Taiwan, then you can probably assume that in the next, what I call the decade of concern, but it could be much sooner, as we discussing offline here, is that this attack, you know, from China could occur rather quickly. And so we need to cauterize that, and we need to make Beijing understand that if they try to do this, they will pay a dear price for not only attacking Taiwan, but the American forces that will be inexorably linked and involved with that. Because when China attacks Taiwan, they will be attacking American forces. There's no other way around it. That's part of their strategy. And so we are linked with Taiwan, and Taiwan is linked with Japan, and we're all linked together in trying to sustain the last 80 years of peace and stability that's occurred in the Western Pacific. And China is the one that's desperately, you know, trying to disrupt that by taking physical control of Taiwan. And that's the concern, and we should not allow them to think otherwise.
Jim, let me turn to another idea, and one again that you've advocated manfully for years, and that is shoring up our alliance relationships with others in the region. We've talked a bit about Japan. We've talked a bit about Australia. South Korea is increasingly problematic, is it not? I'm just looking at an article today of the South Korean ambassador to the United States told lawmakers in the South Korean capital of Seoul, quote, "Just because South Korea chose the U.S. 70 years ago doesn't mean it has to choose the U.S. for the next 70 years, too." A not-so-subtle suggestion of a separate peace, and there's plenty of reason to believe that's the attitude of Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, is it not? Where are we with respect to the South Koreans, and what does that mean for our alliance posture in the region?
Yeah, I think what's going on in the Korean Peninsula, and I'm no expert by any stretch, but my involvement with the peninsula was, you know, extensive over the years. And what I see is that Korea is going through kind of a struggle right now internally, where you have the Moon administration, which was a report from Grant Newsham this last week talked about the influence of Chinese cyber activity in the election of President Moon. And so there's Beijing desperately wants the South Korean government inside their sphere of orbit and to break away from the United States. That's their one of their goals. And it seems that maybe President Moon seems to be sympathetic to that kind of thinking. And statements by this ambassador clearly support that assertion. That said, my experience on the peninsula and dealing with the ROK military and the people of Korea, I'm not sure that President Moon's feelings are shared by everybody in Korea. And the people of Korea know, the pain that they suffered at the hands of the North Koreans that were funded and aided by the Chinese and the People's Republic of China. They know that very well. And so I think the United States, has its work cut out for us to try to, get the folks in South Korea that believe this way to take part in their government and to stand up and maybe reassert themselves. I think they're trying, but it's a very difficult situation, especially since, South Korea's largest trading partner is the People's Republic of China. And so it's a really it's a delicate situation. And America and South Korea have fought together and shed blood together. And I think we should not forget that. And that doesn't mean it's an automatic guarantee for another 70 or 80 years or 100 years. But I think there's something there that the people of Korea really need to understand, which is to say, like we were saying earlier in the hour, the people of Taiwan are seen in Hong Kong. I think the people of South Korea need to look at what happened in Hong Kong, look at the threats at Taiwan, and ask themselves, is this really what they want? I don't think the people of Korea want to be subjugated to the Chinese Communist Party.
Let me turn finally to one quick question to you, both as a longtime military man and as a clear-eyed thinker about these challenges. What do you say to people who are currently investing mostly other people's money, American investors' money, that is, in Chinese companies? Just as an example, the Chinese Construction Communications Corporation, which was intimately involved in building out those island bastions in the South China Sea that you described a moment ago. It's on our capital markets. Some of its subsidiaries have been listed on the Commerce Department's entities list for their ties to the People's Liberation Army and their threats to our national security. What would you say to people who are enabling this, the financiers on Wall Street specifically, making possible some of these very dangerous activities on the part of the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, I would say, Frank, it's actual criminal neglect on their part to give money to the People's Republic of China that will be turned around and used against America's sons and daughters that are serving in the military at a minimum. It could be used against the mainland or your continental United States in an extreme case.
Jim, we have to leave it at that, but thank you for your expertise on all of these issues and for joining us from time to time to discuss them. We'll look forward to further updates with you in the days ahead. Jim Fennell, thank you for all that you've done for our country in uniform and now out of it. It's an absolutely indispensable service, and we're so grateful. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.